This episode was made possible by our incredible patrons. Their faithful support allows us to continue the work of amplifying the voices of spiritual abuse survivors. We are a small team composed of two families. We committed early on to not monetizing any of the stories, so we rely solely on the donations of our Patreon community to operate. If you value the work and are able to contribute, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Another way to support Bodies Behind the Bus is by following, rating, and reviewing the podcast. It only takes a moment, but has a tremendous impact on our reach. Thank you for daring to listen.
Today, we are honored to bring you Mandy's story. This story is about her time in a non-denominational church in Wisconsin. Mandy will share about how she broke free after almost 2 decades of service, loyalty, heartache, and abuse in an extremely high-control religious environment. While she is now free, leaving was costly. And today, she is bravely taking one more step into reclaiming her agency and her voice by sharing part of her journey with us. If you listen and recognize yourself in this story, you're not alone, and there is life on the other side. I'm Jonna Harris, and this is the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
I am all about blessed subtraction. There is a pile of dead bodies behind the Mars Hill bus. And by God's grace, it'll be a mountain by the time we're done. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast. We are honored to have Mandy on the podcast today to share her story about her time at her church in Wisconsin. Mandy, welcome to the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This is a unique story for us as a podcast. It has been a long time in the making. We have taken a couple cracks at it. Mandy has done so much work in the behind the scenes just to kind of flesh out how to even tell this story because it spans so long.
Yeah, so I think I would like just if you could start, Mandy, with talking a little bit about what was the church like? How long were you at the church? And when you started, what was the culture like there?
So we were there for about 19 to 20 years. I started going in about 2003. And when we first started going, it was hippie-based, very everybody loves everybody. Everybody's accepted. Everybody's welcome. And it was very based off of the Calvary Chapel movement from back in the 60s under Chuck Smith. And that was kind of the idea that was there. And the main thing that we heard a lot of was love Jesus, love everyone. So when I walked in the door, there was every sort of person you can imagine there.
It sounds beautiful. So your first experience walking in was, wow, these people really care about what they believe and they love each other. And it felt like community, right?
Yeah. And as a college student, that's what I was looking for was community. And they really reached out to the college students. So there was a lot of college people there, people who had come from college and stayed there and started working within that community. And it really was a family and I was seeking family. I came from some crazy family background. And so that's what I really, really desired. And they gave that to me.
And before we move on, I just want to point out that you guys or that church was no longer associated with Calvary Chapel by the time you got there, correct? So it was
correct.
Just
right. We had now become its own entity.
And it remains that to this day.
Yes. At the time of our leaving, there were 2 other church plants with a 3rd one planned that were from that church.
Gosh. Whew. Okay. So as you walk in the door, you like it enough to stay. You say, all right, I'm going to come back.
I do.
Can you describe to us what the culture was like? What did you learn as you started getting ingrained there into the community?
So what really drew me in was the Bible. The pastor at the time, Pastor D, taught verse by verse from the Bible. So Wednesday nights was Old Testament and Sundays was New Testament. And that's what drew me in. And that's, I was learning about how the Bible connected throughout history and how Jesus spoke to us through the Bible and the relationship that he wanted to have with us. It was all Bible-based. And I grew up in the church. It wasn't verse by verse. It was stories and Sunday school stories. So this, what I connected to was the relationship that I could have with Jesus. And then through that, the people, they were honest with me. They, you know, they wanted us to live the life that God had planned for us. And the sky was the limit, we were told. We could dream big and do what God wanted us to do. And we were encouraged to read our Bibles in the morning. I had never really done devotions. So we were encouraged to do daily devotions and to pray with our friends. And we'd have people text us, hey, what do you need prayer for today? This was before social media. So we couldn't really interact with each other on social media in this way. So there was just a lot of texting back and forth and hanging out. Oh my gosh, there was something to do every Friday night. Every Saturday, there were people to hang out with. And it was like you were connecting solely on your relationship with God. It was really, really awesome. It's kind of like, I feel like a honeymoon period. So
when does the culture start? Well, let's explain this first, because I think it's important before we decide when the culture shifts. What was the leadership structure of this church?
Okay, so the leadership structure was based off the Mosaic structure type. So you had Pastor D, who was at the top, and then he had, at the time when I started going, there was only one assistant pastor, and then there was a board of elders, all men, I think six at the time. And then there would be, you know, depending on different ministries, there was a leader in each of our ministry. Eventually they brought on, he was called an associate pastor. So then there were three pastors. So everything went from the top down, and Pastor D had the ultimate final say. He also told us often that he had an accountability pastor outside of the church who would keep him accountable to the decisions. So he wasn't just doing things on his own. So we were told this often. We never saw him. We never really talked to him. I think he may have come in once as a guest speaker, but he was never part of meetings or anything like that. So
you have a pastor that has elders, but he's not accountable to those elders. So all authority runs through him, all decision making runs through him. So right then and there, it's a very dysfunctional leadership structure for a church.
He often said from the pulpit that he knew people thought that his elders were yes men. And he would argue that from the pulpit, that his elders could dispute him at any time. And they were there purposely to correct him if needed. So we were told that often from the pulpit. When you go behind the scenes, you knew that wasn't true.
So, Mandy, so talk to us. What was unique about your story to me was that within this church, you had these different classes that were possible. They almost looked like, you called them schools, and there was three schools. Yep. And you had to apply to get into these schools, right? So can mm-hmm. you explain to us, what were these schools? What were the purpose of them?
Yeah. So when it first started, it was just a Sunday school type class for anybody who was a regular attendee at the church. And the idea was to come in and you would learn about how to study the Bible. So we would have weekly meetings for an hour about different ways you could study the Bible, different ways you could read it. We did the history of the Bible for like a year, I think. So this class was more to enrich what we were already doing. Then there was the school, the leadership school, and that was Pastor D's school to train leaders to become pastors. At its beginning, it was only men allowed in that school and wives, but wives weren't considered part of the school. They were tag-alongs. And they would learn about how to be a pastor, how to plant churches, go deeper into doctrine than we, you know, would, and have discussions. Later, we still had those two top-tier classes, so the school leadership and then the Sunday school class. But then there was a third one added when we started Covenant and Covenant membership, and that was for anybody who wanted to be a Covenant member. So in that class, they would learn, what was our church doctrine? What does Covenant membership look like? What does that mean? And they would go through that, I think, about 2 years before they were allowed into the Sunday school class, where regular Covenant members were. And I don't think there was any requirement to pass the class, but they did have to apply for Covenant membership in order to get into Disciple the Sunday school's class and become a Covenant member. And then we all had to agree that they were allowed in as Covenant members, that we agreed to their pledge, if you will.
Can you explain what being a Covenant member meant? Like what the rules surrounding that were?
It ebbed and flowed. I think we've talked about it being a moving target, which was very accurate. Towards the end, we would often start meetings with, what does it mean to be a Covenant member? What does this look like? Often what would come up was, as a Covenant member, we are saying that anyone within the Covenant membership could come in and have any say in our life. We were accountable to anybody within the Covenant membership. We could be corrected by anybody within the Covenant membership. So if, let's say, like in mine and Mike's situation, we wanted to have kids, that was open game for anybody to have say into as a Covenant member. The general rule of thumb was you were talking to only two or three people about it, because Pastor D really didn't like it if we were talking to everybody about it. But really, anybody, it just, for the most part, meant you were accountable to this church. You agreed also that you would serve within the church at least 2 hours a week within one of the ministries that they had. You tithed. You were a tithing member. Tithe was never discussed as much as, like, how much we were tithing, unless you weren't tithing. Then often it was your ministry leader or the associate pastor who would come and tell you, you're not tithing enough. You also agreed, in order to leave, you would have a meeting with the pastor and your ministry leader about leaving. So if you didn't do any of those things and you just left, you would be considered in sin and put under church discipline. So a lot of what Covenant membership came down to was, you're pledging your life, basically, to this group of people. You're going to be a part of their life, they're going to be a part of yours, and you're promising to have their back.
And this included, because there's a lot there that I think we should dissect, but this also included, if I remember, if you desired to go see your family on a weekend and it interfered with church or your service, you weren't allowed to go, or you were discouraged to go, correct?
That wasn't part of the 4-page Covenant membership, but it would be talked about in our group discussions about going on vacation, going and visiting family, taking time away from the church. We would have to get permission for that because we had ministries to cover. There were things we had to do. If we were going to leave for any reason, someone from within the church was going to have to take over our duties. So that was a big deal. And Pastor D would often from the pulpit say, we're taking too many vacations. And vacation time from work should be taken from work days and not on weekends. Weekends was for the church. So it made life rather difficult planning.
Anything, right? I mean, you can't plan. Did Pastor D write the Covenant membership?
My understanding was that the covenant membership was written with Pastor D and the elders. They all had a say in it. That is my understanding. And we would get rewrites. We would get updates as they would come up with things. And we had to sign off on it before we left a covenant meeting. So we had no time to digest any changes. If there was a change, we were told that we had to sign a piece of paper saying we agreed to it within that hour. If we did not agree to it, we were told we could set up a meeting with Pastor D and the associate pastor to discuss what we didn't agree with. I don't know if discussion would be the right word for it, but everyone signed it. Now, the one time I did not sign the piece of paper, and I know we're going to get back to that later, is towards the end. We had one last covenant meeting before we left. I did not sign it, and Mike did not sign it. I was too distraught to even do anything. So we left. There's a lot of details with that. I got an email that I did not sign it, and I needed to either come in and sign it or agree to have a meeting. I was not having that meeting. So I came in and signed it. And what that would mean to them is obviously that I was lying, that I was just doing what would put me in their good graces. So they were basically forcing my hand to agree with whatever they wanted me to say or with whatever they were saying. So that was like during some of those covenant meetings, that's where we had to sign when someone was put under church discipline that we agreed that they should be under church discipline, and we all signed it. And that way he had documentation to say, look, you agreed to this. You can't go back on this. You agreed to this.
It sounds like it was changing so much. I don't think it started as a 4-page wild document when you started there. So
if I recall correctly, it was 2 pages.
So it grew a couple pages over the 20 years.
Yeah, and at the time when it started, anybody could become a covenant member. There was no class. When it first started and they rolled it out, they gave it to the people who were there. And they said, sign it, you're in. It became stricter as time went on, as part of the controlling factor of all of this.
So I think that's really important to point out, because I think oftentimes in religious settings like the one that you were in, people hear the end of the story and they think, how the heck did anybody do that? Like, why was anyone there, or why would you ever be a part of something like that? And it's really important to step back and realize that, like, any one of us could be in that situation, because it's not blatant in your face right off the bat stuff that's going on. You are attached to the community, and there's like little pieces of you that are like, I'll be selfless here. I'll give this little part of me that feels uncomfortable with this away for the greater good of the community. And then that snowballs into 4 pages of a covenant that people have say whether or not you decide to have children or not in your life. It is a slow progression of taking away your agency. And I just want people to understand that as we move through your story, that it started in a way that felt beautiful and unique and communal. And unfortunately, it was a group of vulnerable people. You're there for college. You're young. You're alone. You don't have family with you. And there are people out there that will use vulnerable populations and will capitalize on those needs. And they will find ways to coerce them into a control environment where they have final say or control over that community. So that is a huge part of your story. And we see that just right even in that membership covenant situation right there. That's a huge key to it. So as you moved into and explained these classes, towards the end then, people are having to go through this like 2-year process of getting to be part of this 4-page membership covenant and then graduate into these other classes. Did you ever like get apply to those classes and not get in? Is that something that happened to people?
Yeah, that did happen to people because they would be told that they're not committed enough. That, let's say someone applying for covenant membership, it would take them longer because they didn't have their life straightened. One of my friends that I last talked to before I left, the week that I left, had told me she was going through a really hard time, and I was asking her, maybe God's asking you to find another church. Maybe you need to seek that out. And she said, she looked at me and she said, Mandy, I have worked so hard and for so long to become a covenant member. Why would I throw that away? I think it took her, gosh, I want to say 4 years. And she had been at that church long before covenant membership. But she was constantly being told that she wasn't, her life wasn't together, that she wasn't committed enough, and a myriad of other things, that she was boy crazy and, you know, dream crazy, that she wasn't committed to the church. And they would often joke about her behind her back, and they've broken up her relationship with a guy that they had felt had leadership potential, and yet she's being told she's the crazy one. And so you have instances like that with her where she doesn't feel like she could leave because she put so much into it. It must mean something. God obviously allowed that for a reason. And that's often where we're put in these situations where we know it's not right. At the core, we know something feels wrong, but we're being fed that it's me. It's my sin. It's my bad thoughts. And that's what the struggle is with that. And when you do want to leave, you know you're leaving everything. So that's really hard, especially that's why it took at least 3 years for me to get out when I knew I had to leave, because you're leaving behind a whole community.
Gosh. And once you actually ascended into covenant membership and then you got into these other classes, what was the culture of those classes like? Or was there a hierarchy within those classes? What did that look like? Because I know that was a heavy part of the culture at your church.
Yeah, so within the class itself, there wasn't a hierarchy. There was a pastor who would run it. When I left, the associate pastor was running our class. And it was literally for an hour, we'd sit down and we'd talk about some material we were going through. At the time when I left, it was the Scofield material. And then from there, branching out from the class itself, you were put into ministries that had that hierarchy. So within the different ministries, let's say the coffee house that I was a part of, there was the ministry manager or leader. Then he had a body of leaders, which could be men or women within that leadership structure. And there were women leaders of the coffee house. And then there would be everybody else who would work. Typically, if you were a ministry leader, you were in that ministry school, that leadership school, because that ministry that you were running was teaching you how to eventually, hoping to plant a church or to go out and plant a ministry. So that we were always told there was some purpose behind it. So we always had like this feeling like we could move up. And if we did so much, if we did so well, we would get asked to take on more responsibility, which looked good. That's what was promised to us. So within the class itself, sitting in there, there wasn't. I mean, there was the clicky, like, if you were in there, you knew who was always going to answer the questions. You knew who always had the right answer, who was always going to get shot down by the pastor. But that's more of a cultural thing. It wasn't a hierarchy within the class itself. So
you need an org chart, organizational chart to figure out this church.
And it's really funny because there used to be one that was in like the bathrooms as a poster.
That would be helpful and right it, now.
Yes. And it was like chutes and ladders. It was actually literally shaped like chutes and ladders. And I've teased the person who's made it because he's no longer in there and he doesn't even remember making that poster. But I can't even imagine people coming in
what
going,
is this?
What yeah. hoops do I have to jump through? And we would repeatedly be told, there's no hoop jumping here. You don't have to earn anything. So that's where you get this, like,
right. Like, what? You're being told one thing, but the reality was just completely different.
Right.
So you mentioned the coffee house. What are some of the other ministries? And then what was the expectation of you within those ministries? And were any of these staff positions?
There was only, when I left, there were only three paid staff positions. So there was the pastor, the assistant pastor, because the associate pastor had moved into the assistant pastor position. And then there was the coffee house manager. Those were the only three paid positions. There were several different ministries that you could serve in, volunteer in. It was always volunteer, and you always agreed to volunteering. So there was the coffee house. There was a magazine, a college magazine. There was the deacon ministry, which my husband was a leader in. He was a deacon, but we weren't in the leadership community. And then there was also a radio. We had a radio station. And then I think those were the four main ones, the coffee house. And those were all, the cleaning ministry. I forgot. The cleaning ministry was also another ministry that was all volunteer.
Like dry cleaning or like cleaning?
Cleaning homes? The bathrooms, cleaning the church. It was only cleaning at the church, and it was two hours. And we were prided ourselves that we didn't pay a cleaning staff.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Was the purpose of all of these ministries to actually try to minister to the community? Was that the intent?
The coffee house, yes. The radio specifically, were the magazine, all of them were to minister to the community.
Did any of it work?
Some. I mean, we did get people in through the coffee house, obviously, because people would come down for coffee. But often I have spoken to people who have said it was just so weird. It was a weird vibe because we were, I don't want to say forced, because that would not be the term that was used. We were encouraged to always talk and have a conversation with whoever came in. Now the radio staff was reaching out to people over the airwaves. They would put out the sermons. There was also, they worked with a video side shoot of a video ministry that would put off, you know, videos onto a, we actually were on the CW. We ran our sermons on the CW. So the whole idea was to reach the community. We didn't get a lot of people. We got a lot of college students that would come in and out. But when we got older people, my age in their 40s, or I mean, there was hardly anybody in their 60s and above. They weren't there for very long. I could give you a number of reasons why, but it would be speculation. I'm sure you can guess why they weren't very long.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure because they weren't young kids that were easily manipulated, and they were like, what the heck is going on here? Get me out of here.
Well, and often they were coming for community with, these people had kids. Like, I was in the couples ministry, and we would often talk about, why aren't couples coming to our church? Now, having small kids, I can't imagine having that schedule. And those people had that schedule. I mean, on top of just those main core ministries, we're talking about, there was a homeschool ministry, singing ministry, like a worship team, sound ministry. There were lots of little offshoot things that you could be a part of. And it was a lot.
And the requirement was how many hours of service a week?
Two. However, the coffee house, which I was a part of, was a four-hour shift. One day a week, and then one Saturday a month. So, and then my husband would have, he was limited to 2 hours. It was very, very explicit that he only served 2 hours a week. The deacons only had two. But if they had to work on a Saturday to do like a full workday, an eight-hour workday, they would get that day off that they worked during the week. So like I said, it was kind of a moving target because they weren't the same throughout the different ministries. And our schedule just really wasn't our
own. For you, then, you had to work 4 hours during the week at the coffee house.
Yes.
And that was the only requirement for you, outside of you had a small group that met for 1 hour a week, essentially. And then how long were you guys there? Was there any other service projects, or how long were you there on Sundays then?
So Sundays, we would be there from 8:30 in the morning till essentially 4 p.m. in the afternoon if we had our couples ministry meeting. If we didn't, then we would be free to go like at 1 o'clock. But we were essentially there at 8:30. If I had my coffee house shift on a Sunday, then I would be there at 6:30 in the morning, which I did for a really long time. So it could be 6:30 till 4. And for a while, I was even going home to do stuff for the coffee house to order groceries. So I would be doing church stuff from 6:30 in the morning till almost 6 at night. So, and let's not add in, if I had a missions trip I was going on, that was almost every other week of planning.
So, and that was not uncommon for anyone in your community, correct? Like, you guys were all giving this much.
Yeah, and it was expected, especially of the leadership team, to stay. Like, when Mike became a deacon, the other deacon with him was told, it was highly encouraged that he stay for the lunch that was served and stay till the next ministry thing started so that he could engage with people, he could talk with people. People left in between things, but it was highly looked down upon and highly discouraged.
Would happen if someone did something that, if someone didn't do what they was expected of them?
So something, we followed the church discipline guidelines within the Bible. First, someone from your ministry
group
will
come
and talk to you.
So and so didn't go to lunch. Yeah.
Possibly. I've had, hey, that text didn't look right, and it seemed like you were not meaning what you said. And then I was having a correction discussion. It could be over a cup of coffee. It didn't have to be anything that was necessarily set. This could just be an offhanded comment. Someone's meeting me in the hall and they're telling me they need to correct me on something. They wouldn't use those words, but okay. So then it's one person coming to you. If I still was not listening to their counsel, then two people would approach me. It would be more of a meeting setting. I would schedule a meeting. We would sit and talk about it. It might be several of those meetings. Leadership would often say, we're not just booting people out the door. We're giving them a great, authentic chance to right their wrongs. So this could be several meetings with two people, the ministry leader and the pastor. Eventually, if you did not fly right or do what they were saying, the pastor would call it burning things to the ground, and they just left, is what it looked like. And then we would have a covenant meeting. We would get read their church discipline letter and told why they're no longer with us, how they've sinned against the church and what that looked like. Maybe not every single detail, but we would get told an awful lot. We were not allowed to go and talk to them once they left. We were told they no longer want to be a part of us. They are under church discipline. We need to treat them like they're non-Christians, which means we, in our eyes, apparently, that you shut them out. Social media, you take them off of social media. They are no longer allowed to see the great things we're doing. They didn't want to be a part of our life. So you take them off of social media. You don't talk to them. You don't respond to them. You don't hang out with them. We were talked to about what to say to those people if we saw them in the grocery store. So let's say I'm at Walmart and I run into somebody who's under church discipline. I was told to say, hi, how are you doing? Okay, and leave. Because I didn't want to open it up to discussion about how they're going to bash the church. because that's what it was often said, is anybody who would leave, all they do is bash the church, how bad Pastor D is, how awful he was. And we were told that the people who left and were under church discipline no longer loved us. And they never did, because they're not staying. So this is the kind of pressure
we're under. And these are people, are some of those people like staple community members that you had to say goodbye to at any point? Or were they people that you guys like had a relationship with and cared about?
Every single person that left, I loved dearly. Every single person. And it broke my heart because I got so used to it that I could see when they were starting to back off, they would start to shut down. There was a look in their eyes that they didn't believe what was going on here anymore. You could just see it. And we were told that was going to the dark side. Satan's talking to them. Satan has control of them. I mean, these people, I've reconnected with a lot of them. We're not friends. Like we're palling up and hanging out. We all have our own lives now. But these were people that I shared tears with, wedding, happy memories, exciting milestones, missions trips, praying with, growing in our own relationship, questioning the things that we had in our lives. You know, they were, some of them were best friends. And to just shut them off, it's like ripping your heart out every time. And Pastor D would often say that when you leave, you're ripping my heart out when you do that. And that's another part of why it was so hard to make that decision to leave, because you knew you were no longer going to have your best friend.
Thanks for sharing that. I think it's important for us to understand all of those things are looming over your community as we move into a little bit more of like your own personal story, so that people can understand how your story was even allowed to happen. Like, they need to understand all of those things are weighing into why you move the way you do, or why you allowed certain things to happen the way that they happened.
It's tragic and it's scary that that amount of control is anywhere. And it just breaks my heart, honestly, because you just see the goodness of Christ and the goodness of what Jesus wanted, and the diversity and the freedom that he gave people, and the agency that he gave people, gobbled up and used by a man and a group of men to control and manipulate people into fearing for their salvation and worth. I can't think of something, I mean, that is so wretched and so evil. And it's just sad. It's just really sad.
Yeah, that's probably another important note just to add, that towards the end, when I left and we had a mass exodus, we were told that these people probably weren't saved when they left. So that's the other thing that you're dealing with, is your salvation. Because that's, you're supposed to be confident in your salvation. And now for everything that's coming at you, because you are trying to sort through this, even to question, now you're suddenly not just having questions, you're questioning your whole foundation of salvation. And what is that supposed to mean? What is that supposed to look like? And so that's a whole nother layer that is just icky. So.
Well, let's move into specifically talking about, like, toward the end of your time there, where your story really, you know, where your story really gets, for lack of a better term, interesting. And I think to start that, I was very saddened and heartbroken by the way Pastor D viewed marriage and kids. So I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about that, and then we can get into your relationship with Mike.
Yeah, so when I first started coming, I would say anybody could get married at any time. We could have premarital counseling, and get the Pastor D would marry us, and kids were encouraged. It seemed over time, and I really don't know when the culture shift happened, but over time, you would hear often from the pulpit that marriages were failing, that we weren't doing marriage right, And there were divorces. I had one. I was one. And that kids being raised within our church were not being raised correctly because they kept leaving when they got of age, you know, when they got 18, they left. And the general thought was that if they're being raised right, they should want to stay and serve God within this church and be with their family. And so we would have parenting classes. I was part of a parenting class with my husband. Pastor D said he did run a parenting class. He was not a parent, but he, at one point after running a parenting class, said, we're not going to listen to him. So he's not going to run that parenting class anymore if we're not going to listen to him. So, however that was supposed to look to him, look like very well-controlled little soldiers.
Was having kids encouraged?
No.
In your congregation?
No. Within the couples ministry, when we would talk, it was, yeah, of course you can have kids. You can do whatever you want. God can, you know, it's, kids are great in the Bible. But when you're told things like in class, before I left in my Sunday school class, the associate pastor in the Schofield material was going through parts of it that said, we are no longer under the covenant that said we were to fill the earth with children. So we don't need to have children. And it was thought that if we wanted children, more often than not, we were told it was idol worship because we wanted children. And the same was looked at with having a boyfriend or a girlfriend. Make sure you're not idol worshiping them. Make sure that they're not having this place in your heart where you're putting them above God. Those two factors were very much like you're constantly fighting because you want it. It's a good desire. The Bible says those things are good. But then you're being told on the other hand that if you want it too much, it's idol worship. So what does that look like? So no, it was not encouraged. And in fact, we were often told that we, you know, again, this was a moving target. Before we got engaged, we should be in counseling for that. So let's say when Mike proposed to me, he should have started premarital counseling meetings long before he ever proposed. He didn't know he wanted to propose until that night. So, you know, some things are spontaneous. And, you know, then when we're in premarital counseling, we're put through a rigor of testing the foundation of our relationship and seeing if God really wants us to have this relationship and if this is of God. Then it's the pastor or whoever's running the counseling with us that deems, yep, you're ready to get married. Let's do this. Let's plan it. And for us, it took 2 years. We didn't know when we were going to get the go.
Can you walk us through when you met Mike and how your relationship progressed a little bit and what the church's influence on that was?
Yeah. So I met Mike in 2003 when we first started coming, which is really funny. But he and I didn't become friends, didn't start liking each other till after my divorce. He gave it the appropriate, what he felt was appropriate, 2 years till he started talking to me. And he asked our ministry leader, he gave him a call and asked him if it was okay if he asked me on a date. And it was highly encouraged that he asked me on a date. And everyone was like, that was a good thing that he asked me out on a date, which meant coffee. So when we first started dating, everyone was totally for it. One, we were in our 30s. Mike was the bachelor of bachelors. He had a house. He wasn't living in a basement playing video games. He had a job. So this was seen as a good thing when I first started coming, or when we first started dating. Then 6 months in to dating, Mike knew when he started dating me that I was going to be the one he would ask to marry me, or marry him, apologies. He had told me that he would not date anybody unless he had intention to marry them. So I was the first person he ever dated. But he didn't have thoughts about asking me to marry him. He's such a planner that it would have taken him forever. So we were in a fight one night. We were like, where are things going? What are we doing here? And then he asked me to marry him. It was as simple as that. He knew it's what he wanted. The next day, we emailed the pastor and we told everybody they were on a missions team in India. All of our best friends were on that trip that Mike had asked me to marry him. And everyone was really excited. They were more upset that they weren't there and couldn't celebrate with us. We later found out that Pastor D was actually upset that Mike had not asked for permission. So from that beginning, it was tainted. And then we were pulled, and you know, Mike had to make the first step and make an appointment for premarital counseling. Pastor D had said he's no longer doing premarital counseling, but he's going to do the first meeting. He's going to shotgun all these questions at us and see which one hits, meaning he's going to see if he can break us within that meeting. Two vivid things that I remember from that first meeting is he looked at me and he asked me if I manipulated Mike into asking me to marry him because I had already broken one marriage covenant and I had already destroyed and manipulated and pushed away one husband. Why would this man, who's never dated anybody else, basically want to marry me without me manipulating him? And I looked at Mike and I was like, I don't think I manipulated him. But in the moment, you're thinking, well, did I? Because we had a fight. Maybe I pushed him into it. And then he looked at Mike and he said, you have a house, man. You have a full-time job. You have money. Why her? Why now? And then, okay, guys, you can go off and meet with the next pastor until you're ready to be married. And we had to do a marriage book. We had to go on project dates to discover more about each other. They were called project dates. And they would test whether or not we agreed on all the things. And we had to meet with other couples, have dinner with them and ask them about marriage and their struggles and all these things. We had to read what was called the Red Book. And it was based off of basically all the ins and outs, very detailed and lots of pictures about sex. And we had to have the sex talk.
Wait, who gave you that book? The pastor?
That was given to every couple that went through premarital counseling. And there was a joke one time that Pastor D said to Mike in front of everybody in the coffee house. Now, we were sitting with a bunch of friends. And Pastor D came up to Mike and said, you know, you're about to get married, you know, and Mike, he's very uniform. And yeah, he just said, yeah, I've been reading the Red Book. And Pastor D's like, oh, I bet you're making notes, you know, because she's been married before and you haven't. And so basically demasculating him in front of everyone and also humiliating me because, yes, I had been married before. That doesn't mean I know anything. And so some of the other things we would have to do is we would have to watch videos. We would read Gary Thomas material. We read Real Marriage. So there was a lot of books that we had to read, which is a lot of work on top of what everything else we were doing. So this is a huge commitment. We also weren't allowed to tell our family a date. That was very explicit. We were not allowed to plan our wedding until they gave us permission. So everything was like, we had to do this perfectly in order to get the go-ahead to go get married. Now, having said that, Pastor D would often say, go get married by anybody else in the church. You have our blessing. Go elope. Go get married in the town hall. Anything. You don't have to get married in this church, but if you want to get married in this church, this is what's required of you. So in your mind, this is the way to go. Because obviously it's better, right? You want to get married in the church and by the pastors that love you. And having said that, we had to go through a talk or a meeting about what a wedding would look like because Pastor D hated big weddings. He did not want it to be a big pop and stance type thing, which I was often humiliated in front of people and in front of sermons. When he would put question and answers out there, he would point at me about how large my first wedding was, and that it was the biggest wedding he'd ever seen. And so now we're in this getting ready to get married again, being told, is there anything in the Bible that talks about having to have a big wedding? Do you have to do it that way? Do you have to invite your family?
I mean,
so
the weddings in the Bible sound like a freaking party, though. So
they do now, looking back on it. But at the time when you're being told this information, you're like, well, yeah, I guess it doesn't say we have to have a big wedding. And we're really being encouraged.
Why would he care about the size of the wedding?
Because it took too many people to put it on. Our people were the caterers. Our people were the wedding planners. Our people were the photographers. Our people were the videographers. It took too much time away from the church because it would be a Saturday and a Friday. And you know what can go into wedding planning. And then everyone's tired for Sunday. So that's my take on it. And I have heard that. One wedding I was at, I was the personal attendant, and we literally, the mother said we were the best catering service she's ever had because we knew how to do it. We were a full running restaurant at one point, and we were thinking about going into the community and offering this to the community. So we knew how to do it.
For free.
It was just
for free.
Yeah. Oh,
like you guys were working for free.
Yeah, but it was out of the goodness of our heart. Of course we're going to be part of a wedding.
Serving
and
God.
We were serving
yeah.
God. And Pastor D would always give a huge sermon during the wedding, by the way, which was like a mini sermonette for 45 minutes or whatever pastor was there. So it wasn't just, I mean, my first husband and I sat off to the side during our wedding while he gave a mini sermonette on Jesus returning and the 10 virgins. So it was very awkward.
When you would do like these dates, these project dates, or would you go back and debrief them with the I guess associate yep. pastor?
At the time, the assistant pastor. Yeah, it's hard to put all of that together, but yeah, we actually did one wrong, and we were told we had to go back and redo it because we obviously didn't understand the assignment.
So he would critique whatever assignment he gave you. He had the ability to critique whether you passed that assignment or not.
Yep.
So how long did this premarital counseling thing, how long did it go on for?
My recollection is a year and a half to 2 years from the start of engagement till we got married.
And you didn't tell your family you were engaged?
We told them we were engaged.
Okay.
We did let them know we were engaged. The hardest part was when we had to tell them that they weren't invited to our wedding, that we were going to have just a small wedding. It was obviously our choice. We were always counseled in that to say that it was our choice to our family. This was Mike's first wedding, so to not have any of his family there was very difficult. Now, having said that, Mike and I honestly loved our wedding day simply because, man, there wasn't a lot of the wedding stress and all of that. So we look back on it with fond memories, but at the same time, we had to plan two separate parties for our families, and we were told that no one from the church could come to those parties because we didn't want to make anybody jealous for not, like if we didn't invite somebody and they didn't get to go, pastor didn't want any jealousy.
It was so, like elementary school birthday party rules. Oh,
yes, and that's how birthday parties were. We couldn't have birthday parties for that same reason. It's not that we couldn't, but it was highly discouraged because of that reason. We didn't want to leave anybody out. And actually, we got to have one of the highlights was we did have wine at our wedding. The only reason I say that is because a lot of times Christian weddings, we end up not having wine because of people who have alcoholism and things like that, or it's highly discouraged for Christians. So we were at a winery. We had our little wedding at a winery. We had picnic on the grass. Like it was a tea party with, I think we had a total of 5 people there from the church, and they all had very specific roles. But it was a really that's again why it's so hard to leave, because it was a very, very beautiful moment for my husband and I. And at the time, we didn't see it as manipulation. We didn't see it. We thought we were doing a really great thing and that our parents were in the wrong for having the feelings they were having. Because my dad even motorcycled out 2 days before the wedding to come to our wedding, and I had to say, you can't come.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is how your families reacted to this.
Not favorably. My mom was understanding. My brother had actually eloped 6 months prior because he was in the military, and so was his wife. So, and I had already had the big princess wedding. So for them, it wasn't as big of a deal. Although I don't know if I actually said, I mean, I think they would have loved to have been there. Obviously, it was Mike's family that really took it harder. And I understand that. They couldn't see their only son get married, and they had wanted this for so long. They honestly thought he was going to be single for his whole life. They wanted to celebrate with him, and they were being told, I'm sorry, you can't celebrate with us, that we have to do it separately. So
I'm so sorry. Well, it doesn't end there.
So you did get married.
We did get married.
And then which is good. I mean, and you guys have, I mean, you're married today, you have a healthy marriage, happy marriage. So that's a good thing out of all of this.
Yeah, we're actually celebrating 10 years next
month. That's amazing.
You survived.
Yeah, to survive all of this. And statistically, second marriages, that's the thing we were also told, don't survive past 7 years. The statistics aren't very good. But we're beating the statistics, which in my mind is such a great thing, because, you know, we've had all this trauma on top of all of it. I've had a second marriage. And as we'll go into, we have special needs within our kids. I mean, there's just so many odds going against us. But man, you know, we do love each other. We're such dorks and we get each other. And it's not like we don't fight. Our marriage isn't perfect. We're trying to figure it out, but neither of us want out. We've made that.
That's awesome.
I mean, we make that clear all the time. So
talk to us about the kids, right? So you both decide you want to have kids, but at your church, that's not just a couple decision. That's a church decision. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's council decision. So Mike in our premarital counseling had to write down a life plan. And in his life plan was that we would have two kids. So we always knew we wanted kids, and at least two, especially at our age. We waited because we wanted to enjoy marriage. I hate to say that we wanted to enjoy marriage, because you can enjoy marriage with kids, but we wanted to get to know each other before we had kids and threw kids into the mix. So once we started talking heavily about it, that's when the problems in our marriage really started to show. And again, that's where I started to see cracks with this. There's something not right in this church. Because Mike and I had discussions about it. We just thought, hey, we're going to tell somebody, a close friend, our leadership ministry leader, that we want to have kids. What do you think? Now a good time? Do you think we should wait? What do you see? What are the problems? That's getting counsel. He told us that we needed to meet with other couples that didn't have children and that had children, as to what were the pros and cons of having children, how would that affect our life, what is that going to look like, and to wait. Okay, that was frustrating, because I thought we were just basically letting you know we were having kids, but apparently not. And we would get a lot of comments. I mean, the Pastor D's wife would come up to me. I'm 34 at the time. And she would say things like, oh, you got lots of time. Everyone's in such a rush to have kids. Or she would come up to me and say things like, this is just in conversation, like, boy, these young college kids, they get around a baby and they like get baby fever. Everyone's got to have a baby. Pastor D was just often fond of like saying that you could do, without saying it, that you could do so much more ministry without kids, basically that they weighed us down. So we didn't have to do like pre-kid counseling, like where we did premarital counseling, but we did have to meet, or we were encouraged that we should meet with all these different people. One couple that we met with had three kids, and they were in the leadership community. And I had come with this whole bullet-pointed list of, this is what our finances are going to look like. This is how insurance is going to pay for it. This, everything. Because I wanted kids. I also wanted the fear taken away from my husband because he was put into this position, the men in that church, where they could not make decisions without having basically someone approve that decision. So he was incapable of making decisions because of years of being told you should seek counsel for that. And this couple that we met with, the husband was like, why are you doing this? The Bible says a kid's a good thing. Have kids. What are you so worried about? So that's where, like, again, that moving target would come in, because they had three kids. They obviously didn't do what we were doing. Why were we suddenly being told that? But a lot of it's because kids weren't raised right, according to the leadership. Kids weren't disciplined right. Kids got in the way of ministry. We often would start to say, as parents, we're too busy. We would, again, start to say no, and we were put boundaries. That's ultimately what it would come down to, is now we had to put more boundaries in. And our life wasn't fully open. So I want to say that it was at least a year of us going back and forth, and we had horrific fights, because he would say, yes, I want kids. I'm ready to have kids. The next day we'd be in the car and he'd say, no, I don't think we're ready to have kids. So he was constantly jerking me back and forth without realizing what he was doing. He met, when we finally said, okay, we're going to have kids, he met with the assistant pastor, who was our ministry leader at the time, for supper, and was told in that meeting that the assistant pastor didn't feel that Mike was ready to have kids, and that he was not confident that God wanted us to have kids. So we're back at the start. It wasn't until, I think, 6 months later that he went back out with that same pastor and was told, yeah, okay, you can start to have kids.
Why would he say that initially? What was his reasoning to say he wasn't confident?
Because Mike, my husband, had the inability to be confident. Years and years of being torn down and told that the things you are saying are not right, questioning everything you think. Like, if I wanted to go to a different job, I was questioned, why would you want to go to a different job? And so just even being questioned in that environment, you're like, oh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't want to go. So when he has to sit down with an authority who he respects, who he's basically grown up under since his early 20s, and now he's a man in his 30s, having to ask for permission when your wife wants something so desperately, you know that God says it's okay. But you have the inability to say confidently that, yes, God wants me to do this, because then you're playing the God card. Because once you throw that God card down, Pastor D would say, my hands are off it. If it blows up, it blows up. If it's good, it's good. Well, you don't want it to blow up. So, I mean, you could see it on all the men there. I had men who would talk to me about not feeling worthy about being married, about asking a girl out because he didn't know if it was a good idea, or they didn't know if it was a good idea to take this job, and I should sit and pray on it for months. So that was just part of the culture.
So you ultimately have kids, or you do have kids. You have two kids, and they're blessed. Kids are great. Another thing too, like, just remove the God. Like, I want to say this, like, just remove the, if anybody's in this situation, remove the God thing for a minute. Like, if you are married, hell, if you're just out there in a committed relationship and you decide you want kids, have kids. Like, I mean, that's one of those things that you can do freely. It's not like you putting God on that is a weird thing as well too, because the ability for us to have kids is not something that, if you want to pray about it, pray about it, but you don't have to. Like, people have the free will to have children. And I find that really bothersome, that when I hear that type of language of pastors saying things like, oh, pray about it. If you want to pray about things, great. But sometimes God's not going to tell you what to do about kids or jobs. Sometimes you just do it. And anyways, that's just my opinion and my little soapbox.
And that was said from the pulpit. That's the other part that is thrown into this, because he would say things like that from the pulpit.
Yeah. See,
that's not what was happening in conversation when you're repeatedly told you need to seek counsel and were asked, how long have you been praying about it? What does the Bible say about it? And have you sought counsel?
Yeah.
Those were the three requirements to make a decision.
Okay. I could go off on that, but I'm not going to. So you do have kids. I want to get into this too, because I was very concerned with the way that they encouraged you to discipline. Well, they encouraged not only you to discipline your kids, but the way that discipline was talked about in the church. So talk to us a little bit about when you had your daughter. What did that look like in the sense of how you were supposed to discipline her in church or in, you know, at your house? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so we had our first daughter in 2019, and spanking was highly encouraged. It was encouraged to not humiliate your child and do it in front of people. So we were encouraged to go into the women's bathroom. There was discussion when I left about not doing it in the women's bathroom and if there was a better place to do it so that people in the community wouldn't hear it or a stranger wouldn't hear it, because we just had stalls. We had three stalls in the women's bathroom, and you'd had to close the door and you'd spank your child, and it was very uncomfortable to be in the next stall and hear a mom spank their child would cry, and you would hear the mom say, be quiet, don't cry too loud, and then talk through why they were getting a spanking. So that was highly encouraged. Spanking was highly encouraged. There were some parents that also said if spanking the butt doesn't work, to smack their hand, but it wasn't encouraged to like slap or anything like that. I want to at least say that, either, you know, good or bad. But I did have a friend who was encouraged to spank her daughter well into her teens and had even spanked her child to the point of bruising and was given praise for that and getting praised for getting called into the police to discuss it because she had left bruises and that it was just a spiritual warfare that they were coming after her. That was towards the time I left. So kids were supposed to be quiet. They were not, during the studies, they were not to be heard. My child, during COVID, we had shut down our kids' ministries. So she grew up those first 2 years without being able to go into a kid's room. So because she would be loud at times, I would go into the cry room. We had a cry room for nursing mothers, and sit and play with her. And the sermon would get pulled into there. And at one time, Pastor D came up to me after a study and had said to my child, oh, so you're the one who is being really loud during my sermon. And what does that say to me as a mom? What I hear is, I'm not controlling my daughter and I'm not keeping her quiet. During the same time, I was trying to get... My first was really tired, and these are long days for these kids. And she was really just crying, so I brought her downstairs, and there's cameras all over, and the security guy is watching the cameras. And I spanked my child several times to try to get her to stop moving and to just sit still and to be quiet and to fall asleep. I eventually get so broken up about this because she wasn't doing what I wanted her to do and I didn't know what to do. I went into the bathroom and I just sat and rocked with her until she fell asleep. Okay. Later, I was told by the security person, hey, it looks like you had a really good fight with your child, but you won the war, so that's good. So you hear that kind of language and you're like, okay, so I'm doing the right thing. I never felt right about it. Now, one thing to note is that my first daughter's on the spectrum. Smacking her hand was like burning her. She hated her hands touched. And so I knew that. And I knew that if I didn't do things in front of people that where they would see me just like smack her hand to get her attention that I would be talked to later about it. So I would do it to get her attention. We were told when we were started to talk to friends about her not listening to us when we would say her name, which is a red flag for autism. Mike was talking to a friend in leadership about it and said, hey, we're just really concerned. She's not, she's a year and a half. She's not even 18 months, but she doesn't seem to listen to us when we call her name without a beat. He says, well, you need to spank her more. You need to discipline. That's a discipline issue. We were just trying to broach the subject of autism because I had known for quite some time, but now we're getting confirmations from doctors. This is scary for parents, but now we're being told it's because we're not disciplining our child. Eventually, because my child, I can't keep her quiet, they live stream the sermon down into the kids' room, and I am put in there with her during the sermons away from everybody else. And this is COVID still. So now I'm not having any contact with anybody, but even during church, because I can't handle my child, I'm in a kid's room with her so she can be loud and be active. It's like, that was basically how kids were seen. They needed to not be kids.
And even with that, she's like 18 months old. So even if your child is not on the spectrum, like I have a 21-month-old right now, and we were at an award ceremony for my oldest yesterday for school, and he was so distracting the entire time, and he's not on the spectrum. Like, that's just part of having a toddler and them learning the world and personalities, and they're humans. They take up space.
Yeah, I can't imagine having my 2-year-old there now because she is wild. But I would have had to spank that out of her. She would not have the personality she has because I would have to spank it out of her. But I was just on that note of sitting through something during a parent meeting towards the end when I was pregnant with my second. I was saying how, you know, my first didn't really sit very well during the studies. And in front of the other parents, one of the head leaders looked at me and said, you really need to try to be training her to sit still for 3 minutes. She's not even 2 yet. And you want me to get her to sit still during a study when she just did a class for an hour before the study? 3 minutes. Do you know how long that is for a parent? So things like that were told. Like, we would have strategy meetings about how to engage our kids in the studies. They would, once a month, when it was before COVID, the kids would sit through and they had to have their eyes on the pastor. And they were encouraged to take notes about what he was saying in form of picture or whatever. But in order to learn how to learn from the pastor, because he's speaking from God. So how was I going to teach a 2-year-old that? I was probably looked at as a not good parent, I'm guessing.
Are having this like internal struggle where you know it's wrong. Like, this part of your story from the beginning, the first time I talked to you, was the part I feel like that has broken you up the most, is just like, and I do think at the same time, there's like a grace in the fact that like your care for your children and your parental instincts kicked in and you're like, no more. I can't keep doing this anymore.
How did they react to you? Were you able to share her diagnosis with the church, and how did they react to it?
So we started slowly. I just had the feeling that this was going to be disruptive. There was no people with special needs within our church, and we actually didn't minister to anybody, to people with special needs, although a lot of us worked in the schools as paras, and some of them were special education teachers. So there was part of me that thought, okay, they'll be understanding, but then there's the other part of me that thought, this isn't going to go over well, because I was looking at a lot of therapy, a lot of time, and we're smack dab in the middle of COVID when my daughter at 18 months is being told that she's going to need some services. And at that time, we were being told by our pastor that we couldn't have anybody in our home because of COVID. So that's initially why I started talking to people, because I didn't want to get in trouble for having therapists in our home. So we're told by the doctor that this in and of itself was traumatic, that she might be severely autistic. And I had been for a long time telling people that she was behind, like I was trying to teach her to roll over, and I would get made fun of for that. And I was told that a lot of kids should just know how to do these things, but that's where I felt like a failure because my kid wasn't doing it. So, and people would make fun of her stimming. She would make a lot of hand movements and facial movements that is very, very on par with kids on the spectrum, and they would tease her. So I'm already getting mama bear. But we started telling people, we would start telling them that she was starting speech. Eventually, a couple months after that discussion with the assistant pastor, we were in front of everybody in the couples ministry, and Mike asked for prayer and said, hey, I just want to put it out there that we're going to have Belle tested for autism. The doctors are concerned that she's autistic. She's been doing speech, and we're really needing some prayer on that. We were expecting our second at the time too. So there was a lot happening. And right away after that meeting concluded, the assistant pastor's wife from the planted church, who had been at this meeting, beelined up to me and said, did you get a second opinion? Because delayed speech doesn't mean autism. How many people have you seen? And I'd seen three doctors. I mean, I don't need to prove this, but good grief. I'd seen three doctors, three speech therapists. I have birth to three telling me, yes, we really do need to start seeking a diagnosis, because the earlier you get a diagnosis for autism, for any special needs, the earlier you can start to get services for that child. And I needed support. Now, I did have two or three friends who weren't in leadership. They were within my Sunday school community who were hugely supportive. And they were like, I want to learn everything about autism so I can help you. I had one of them was a para at a school that brought me a PECS board. So they're pictures that my child could learn to use to speak. So it wasn't across the board. One other note I want to make about that is, we had a couple friend who had been debating about whether or not to have children for years. Mike brought up autism to them, and the husband said to my husband, autism runs in my family. It's one of the reasons I'm worried about having kids here, because I know if our child is autistic, we would not be able to stay at this church. That's not spoken. How does he know that? We had just started telling people about that. So that was like the feeling that was hanging over us. And I had Pastor D at one time, Belle was stimming with her stuffed animal, like choking its neck. And there was a lot of stimulation for that child. So she put up with a lot. And he came up to me and said, oh, isn't it funny? Oh my gosh, she's just choking the life out of that stuffed animal. And I said, yeah, that's stimming. It's part of autism. And he looked at me, he goes, oh, that's not autism. You need to let kids be kids. She's not autistic. What? You've not even asked me anything about my child. And you're giving me a diagnosis? So there was just a lot facing even just that element of wanting to protect my child and to get her the services. And we lived in the sticks. So I was looking at needing to drive half an hour to an hour to get her services, just so that I could take care of this child that God gave me to take care of. That's my job.
I have some choice words that I could say right now, but I'm not going to say them. But I will say this, that you know, your child is beautiful. She was made in the image of God. She has purpose. She has meaning and value. And if a church doesn't see that, that church doesn't need to be a church at all, because that is not what we are and who we should ever be. It's horrible. I am thankful that you got her and continue to get her the resources that she needs to be happy, to be herself, to not be ashamed of who she is. And I thank the good Lord above that you got her out of that hellhole. And that's my opinion, calling it a hellhole.
And mine. So,
You're not the only one.
I'm serious, because no child, in my opinion, needs to be at that church. Nobody needs to be at that church. That man can have Sundays by himself and talk all he wants, because none of us want to listen to him.
Oh, he said he'd gladly just do that.
He's got a radio station. Just put it on repeat. There's a guy that stands at the corner of my little town I live in screaming all these obscenities about all different types of people, and then claiming they're all going to hell and they need Jesus. That's what he needs to be doing, because that guy's ignored, and we just need to ignore Pastor D as well. Anyways, so Johnny, did you have anything to add there?
I mean, clearly it's COVID. You've got all this going on with Belle. You're pregnant. You're like, I need to get out of here. There's a moment that you just decide, I'm done. Can you describe that and then tell us what happened in that and the sequence of events that started?
Yeah. So COVID hits, right? It's crazy for everybody. And that was in March. Everything just shuts down, right? Every state is starting to shut down. All the churches are starting to shut down. And we are now suddenly without meeting with each other. We're a group of people who can no longer serve. So we're left to our own devices, basically. We were told that we could have pods, but they could not involve pods of people who disobeyed the CDC regulations. So that meant my husband's parents. They were not allowed in our home. They have their own opinions about COVID. And they were on a different end. So because of that, we had decided not to have anybody in our home because we didn't want to offend his parents. So I'm trying to play two worlds here, right? I'm having these issues with Belle. I'm not pregnant when COVID hits. But then we start getting letters from the church, from the email letter form, saying how badly we're doing as a church because we're not following CDC regulations. In these emails, people would be called out by name that they hugged somebody. Then they went into a home, which then potentially infected five people within the church and could kill them. Okay. So we have this fear of like everything's shutting down, the world is ending, and now we're being told that we're potentially killing people. This is where the culture really took a huge left turn, because now Pastor D has the ability to put super control on us. So we're getting these emails that the pastor is doing all the work, that no one is able to come in and serve because we can't keep clean, basically, that we can't keep ourselves to ourselves. So they're having to do all of this work. I have emails after emails after emails telling us how bad of a flock we are. Eventually, we get told that we can come and serve if we give a 10-day recollection of everything we did and every human we came in contact with, okay? That wasn't working, obviously. I had put in my 10 days and I had hugged somebody and I got in trouble, and therefore Mike was out. And so shortly after that, we got a letter in email form from Pastor D saying that he wasn't sure that there would be any church left by the end of COVID. That if he was the only one left, so be it. But he was thinking we're all going to kill each other and we're basically, that's the end. At the end of that letter, it said, if you want out, just let us know you want out. We'll be all good and that's okay. I had signed a covenant that said if I wanted out, I had to have a meeting with the pastor and my ministry leader's pastor about leaving. It was my exit meeting and everything would be okay. I also could only leave for three reasons at this time: to help a family member, to relocate for a job, or to go to another church, all of which had to be approved, like that, yes, this was from God. So now I'm given this letter of go in peace if you don't want to be about this church. I read that as, one, it's breaking everything we agreed about in our covenant, because now you just changed the rules, okay? And I signed something different. And so we were going to start meeting back as a church. 1 week after that letter came out, we decided that weekend I needed some time away, because I told Mike, I'm out. I'm done. And he was feeling the pressure. So we went away for a weekend. We had a lot of discussions. They were very ugly. I had melted down in front of an elder about all of this, and I had broke and told him all the things that were wrong about what was going on. We were not hearing from the elders. We were not hearing from the ministry students. We were not being taken care of as a flock. We were just being told we were doing a horrible job instead of being cared for as a flock. And he agreed with me, and he said, you're right. All of this is wrong. Don't leave. Please, I beg you, don't leave. Let me talk to the pastor. I am told that he went and talked to the pastor that weekend that I was gone, and he was put in his place. A week later, he was taken out of the elder board. I came back that Monday. I had another nervous breakdown, basically, with my child there, and I'm pregnant. I should note that just before this went down, I had the thought that the only way to get out of the situation was death. So I had suicidal thoughts leading up to this. I did not have a plan. I want to make that very clear. But I had suicidal thoughts just to get out of the situation. But I couldn't because of my kids. I was pregnant and I had another child. I didn't even have Mike on my mind about it. It was just my two kids. So we get back. I told my in-laws to come get my daughter and that I was going to print this letter out. I was going to sign it. I'm out. I'm done. And that be it. I thought that was my way out. They came and picked her up. I was very scared. I left it, the letter, on the steps of the church. I couldn't even put it in the mailbox. I was so scared. Told the coffee house minister who was leading at the time that I had left it there and that I was done. And I shut off my phone. I had had all of Mike's credit cards from the church and the keys to the church, and I went to Mike's work. And I said, Mike, I'm done. I can't. I don't know if I'm saved. If I can't be here, I don't know if I'm saved, but I can't be here anymore. I gave him the keys. I gave him the credit cards, and I said, you need to decide what you need to do, but I'm done. I went back home, or I went to go get my daughter, and I just felt so sick. It didn't feel like I was free. We go home. I had found out that my best friend at the time had come to the house, that she, I think I may have texted her at some point, that I had left and that I was done. I couldn't do this anymore. And she had come to my house very angry with me for leaving. Mike gets a call that same day from the assistant pastor. And the assistant pastor said to Mike, what's going on, man? We didn't even know anything was wrong. We thought you guys were all good. And Mike was on this whole thing about how for months we've been really struggling. We've had a lot of private conversations, which in that culture are taboo, and that we're just in a very dark place. One of those things that he had said was that we had had an accident while we had a condom break, and Mike had said to me that I hope we're not pregnant because I didn't get permission. And he told the assistant pastor that, and he was very kind about it. This pastor was the nicest of all three of them and very understanding. And he said, look, you guys will be all okay and all good in our eyes if Mandy just apologizes. Mike comes home. I said, I'm not doing it. I am not apologizing. I have nothing to apologize for. We need to be done. We go through all of this for a couple hours, and it was hell. I just cried on the bed, and I finally said, okay, I'll call the assistant pastor. I left him a message and said I'd like to talk to him the next day, and I'll apologize. I talked to the assistant pastor and told him, it was the first time I ever felt very honest with him and said, there is no Holy Spirit here. No one is Holy Spirit led. We talk about it, but we all have to get permission. No one's leading. We have not heard from the leaders. We had this accident, and I have to get permission for this. We're basically being told that I can't touch anybody. I have all of these issues. And he said, look, you're all good. In our eyes, it never happened. Wow. Okay. A week later, we get an email from Pastor D saying we need to have a meeting about what happened. Okay. We thought, you know, the assistant pastor had said we should apologize to the other pastor, so we had done that through email. So we just thought it was a follow-up to that. And we, honestly, I was really hoping that he was just going to ask us, what the heck happened? How did you get from that point to that point? We had not been meeting yet, like in full, like having all these separate ministries and meetings yet. So we were going into this meeting. My daughter was in this meeting. I'm not pregnant yet. My husband's in this meeting. We sit down at the table with Pastor D and the assistant pastor who had said we were okay. And the first thing out of Pastor D's mouth is, okay, you guys broke my trust. I do not trust you. I do not want to know what happened or how you got to this point. Everyone has been horrible during these last couple of months. And that Mike had to get me under control, that I was rebellious, that we had had a lot of discussions behind his back about him that were awful, and that we would be all right and all good with everyone in the church if we came before the covenant members and apologized in front of all of them. No one knew what we had done. So really, technically, even in Bible, I shouldn't have to do this. But we were like, okay. The other stipulation I was given was that I needed to friend up, meaning that I could no longer have my best friend be my best friend because she wasn't a leader and Mike was a deacon. So he was in this weird place of being in the leadership community, but we were still in the Sunday school community. So he said, you need to be talking to women who are leaders, because you need to be acting like a leader. And he told me who to be friends with, and that was to be my friend, and that she really needed a friend. So 2 weeks from that meeting is when we had our big campfire meeting. And for half an hour after we gathered, Pastor D told us how horrible we were to him during this time of COVID, how we had treated him like garbage and put all the work on him. We were also told of several families who were put under church discipline because they were brought into meetings during this time and they did not want to give up their families and wanted to have interactions with their families, and they were put under church discipline for not following CDC regulations. And because they didn't agree with that, they were put under church discipline, and we were told in that same meeting we were no longer to associate with them. To the point where somebody raised his hand and said, I'm in business with that guy. And Pastor D said, I'm sorry, that's done. So now the shunning is becoming even worse. And this is a year before I left. Okay, and then, so now Pastor D opens up the floor and says, who wants to apologize? And who wants to make amends in this meeting for what you did during this time?
So you're like, I guess I'm going next.
Yeah, well, the elder did first. There was the guy that was taken down from the elder board stood up first. And he gave his apology. And then Mike and I stood up. I didn't say anything. I couldn't. I'm obviously not lost for words. But this is the first time I could not speak. I loved these people. And I am being put in front of them, basically bare, not able to tell them what I was going through and the reasons behind it, but just saying, Mike had to say, Mandy tried to leave. We had discussions at home about leaving and about things that were not supposed to be talked about, and we're really sorry. And Mike turned to me and he said, Mandy, do you have anything you want to say? And I'm holding my daughter. I feel like that's so important. And I said, no, I couldn't say anything. And it was forgotten. I mean, later on throughout this covenant meeting, we're talked about again, another pastor spoke up and said how badly we abused our pastor and how shame on us because he's our father and we should not have treated him this way. Then it was brought up, okay, so what is a covenant member? And people had to stand up and say, well, you have authority over our life. And now we're being told that to leave the covenant membership is also like divorce. It's likened to divorce. I've been through a divorce. I can't even put into words how wrong it is to say that. When one, he's never been through it, but now you're trying to tell me that if I try to leave the church, I'm married to the church. Wait, isn't that Catholic? Like, are we pulling a new doctrine? So I actually had to have a discussion with somebody later on after that meeting because she brought it up to me. How it's like divorce. And I looked at her. Now I'm getting bold with people. No, it's not like divorce. I'm sorry. We have reasons we can leave. So you're saying if I can have to go take care of a parent and I leave that I'm divorcing you? And she looked at me like, oh, I never thought of it that way. So now this whole last year, I'm starting to challenge. I'm no longer going to be quiet. I'm not hugely out loud about it, but when questions come up, I'm going to answer them. And I'm not going to. Now, I was never pulled into meetings. I never did it enough to where people noticed that something was wrong. I had learned to mask. I knew how to play the game. So that whole last year of trying to talk to Mike about needing to leave, I'm able to play the game in front of people. It was killing me. I hated it. It felt like living two lives. And I would often, Mike and I would drive to church, which was a half an hour drive, and just tell him how I was spiritually dying. That's what it feels like. You're losing your faith. And then your husband's telling you, well, you need to do more devotions. You need to have a better relationship with God. And he's doing it out of the kindness of his heart because that's what he was told to say to situations like this. So now we're pitted against each other and have been for quite some time. So that's in the midst. That whole last year, we get Bell's diagnosis. The next big pivotal thing that broke me was when the assistant pastor left. We had a big covenant meeting about him leaving, and it felt very dark. So I knew what was going down. And we were told in that meeting that they had to leave to go take care of her parents. They were all good. It was the first time anybody could leave. We were allowed to talk to them. They were leaving under good graces, but we should give them time. Don't talk to them for 6 months. Give them space to move, all of this stuff. And then all of a sudden we're shifted into all the great things the church is doing. And then it's opened up into questions, which at covenant meetings, that's when it was allowed to ask questions, but no one did because often we would get shut down. Mike stood up and said, I'm really sorry. I'm really struggling with this. Why couldn't he say goodbye? Pastor D said to us, it was our fault as a flock that the assistant pastor had said he no longer wanted to pastor because we were too hard to pastor and that he would rather mow ditches than be a pastor at this church. And after he went on this 2-minute spiel to Mike, he said, I don't want any more questions about them. And that was the end of the meeting. We were approached by several people in the community that would say things like, I'm really sorry they left. You were so close to them. It must have hurt you so bad that they left. And I was like, no, they did what they needed to do. They did what God was calling them to do. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Oh, but I'm angry at them because they left. I was told by one person in particular that she couldn't text them or be in contact with them because she felt so angry with them leaving and for ditching us. This is what I'm facing before I finally make the leap to leave with two children. So now we're in, I've had my second child. I'm getting visitors from women within the church who feel safe with me, and they're telling me horrific stories. They're opening up to me about how they fear making any decisions, how they can't leave, how they can't approach people to talk to them, how they wish they were better Christians and that they love Jesus more, and that they wish they could go from one ministry to another, but they were told no, and they really feel like God's calling them to. So I'm having these awful conversations with these women. I've had this year of all this other craziness. I know we need to leave. I had told Mike that I was going to go to my sister's in Illinois. I was going to take the girls. I couldn't do it. I didn't want to leave him. I loved him. But I didn't know how else to get through to him that this was wrong. And he knew it. We knew it. He knew it. Finally, I went to his parents, who I've gone to several times with these issues, and they had tried to talk us out of leaving. My mother had tried to talk us out of leaving as well. Mike's mom finally came to the house and said, look, if Mandy leaves with the girls over this, we're supporting her. This is no longer up for discussion. So on a Friday night, before a work day that he had to be at, that he was running, he wrote a letter saying that we're out, that we're seeking ministry, that we've been called to ministry elsewhere, and that we don't want to be contacted. He worked the whole workday, 8-hour workday. He slipped the letter under the door, and that night he came home. Our girls were with my in-laws. I had packed up the house. I had an anxiety attack. I mean, I had the gamut. I had talked to people who had left and were like, it's okay. You're going to be okay. They were providing resources for us, providing us places to go. We went to a hotel for a week. We went to church the next day. So that was Saturday. We went to a different church for the first time. I wouldn't recommend that. it was awful. And I was really not in a place. Mike started telling everybody that we had, the people that we talked to, that we just left this horrific church, and they looked at us like we were Martians. The church in general, I don't think general people in church don't know how to handle situations like us. So, we'd gone to this church. We actually sought some counsel from that pastor, and he welcomed us with open arms. We knew we were going to be under church discipline, and we explained that. And he said, what you came out of, you're not under church discipline. You need to know that that is not real, what they're saying. It is not real. We get our official letter of church discipline by email. We eventually get it by mail on Thursday. That Thursday, I had been in this hotel for 4 days. Every day we had gotten visitors from friends we had not seen in years. So we put a lot into that week. There were so many tears, so many rejoicings, so many like reunions. It was really a beautiful time at the same time of like our whole world fell apart. We get this letter. My daughters have fevers. They're sick. I'm telling my sister for the first time about what we came out of. And she said, and I'm sobbing. And she said, Mandy, I know that this is a bad situation. and what you have gone through is horrible, but you are not okay. And I really think you need to go to a doctor right now. You need professional medical attention. That was the first time anyone has ever suggested that I might have postpartum depression. I couldn't tell anybody I was depressed before. That wasn't spiritually okay. I needed to be okay with God. I put my girls in the car, and she had told me some medication options, so that was the other reason I wanted to go, was to discuss with the doctor. I drove the girls to the doctor. I'm crying as I'm signing into urgent care. My girls have fevers. I think I have postpartum depression, and I'm ushered to this other spot because they have fevers and we're still in the midst of COVID regulations. This elderly lady comes out of the lab and sees me holding one daughter, and I'm rocking and I'm crying and I'm pushing the other in a stroller. And she said, "Can I please hold one of your babies?" And that was the first time in so long that somebody had asked to take one of my babies because they couldn't under COVID. So she's holding one of them. We get ushered into the emergency room. They had called my husband. He came out of work and they had done the depression test. And I told them that I had suicidal thoughts. Mike takes the girls and they usher me to a padded room where I cried for 2 hours. And the kindest doctor came in and I told him what I had just experienced in brief, obviously, and what I had just lost. And he said, "Look, I don't usually tell people this, but I'm a Christian. This is why I got into this profession. What you went through, what they did to you, that's not Christianity. That's not of God. That's not okay. And you can get medical help if you need it." And that was when we started talking about medication, because again, in the culture we were in, we were not allowed to go on medication. It was highly looked down upon. So I had only heard from one person from the church at this point, and she had said, "Friends don't do this. You need to make it right with the church." So now we have to start everything all over. We had put our house up for sale, left all of that, and started over in where we're now living. We did attend church for a little while, but we're not currently, and I guess right now might be a good halting point if you have questions, but that's when we finally got out, was in July 2 years ago. So, and that two-page letter was 2 pages of manipulation and rant and how horrible we were for leaving. And at the end of the letter, the pastor said, even if we did come back and apologize, we might not be welcome to back into the flock, because we had already tried to leave once and it had hurt them so deeply. So.
I feel like we all need to exhale.
I do that a lot. I have to remind myself to breathe.
I mean, first I want to say, like, you've done such an eloquent job sharing your story, and your story is horrific. And I don't want to, like, we say horrific a lot, but like, this is very bad. And what you went through and what your family went through, it breaks my heart in so many ways that I'm almost speechless. I think that, you know, I'm not really big into like divine intervention, but I definitely think that that person being there, that doctor being there and saying those words are the truth that God wanted to tell you in that moment, that wasn't okay, that how you were treated wasn't okay, and that it is okay to be in need something, to desire good things and to be healthy and happy and all of those things that they stole from you and they stole from your family. And they stole those things and they have no right to that. And I also want to applaud your courage and your husband's courage for leaving, because I can't put myself in that situation, but I've watched enough documentaries and listening to your story, just how much you were at that moment, how much you thought you were giving up, and also the fact that you thought this could be your own salvation that you could be losing, and you still walked away. And I just applaud you for that, because that took so much courage. And your kids and your kids' kids are going to reap the benefit of that courage. And that just is amazing to me. I don't know, John. I don't have anything else to say. I mean, I'm in shock with this story. I've heard it multiple times, and every time I hear it, I'm just like, I'm aghast
by it. It's awful.
So.
Well, the crazy thing is it's only like 10%.
I know.
Right?
I know. It's a part of a story.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just so glad that you got out. And I love that you've been able to connect with other people that have gotten out. I think that what you experienced is so unique, and it's hard to feel. I'm sure it probably even still feels hard outside of it, like you were saying, when you went to that other church and they were looking at you like, what is going on? Like, people can't fully wrap their mind around the experience that you had. So I'm glad that a group of you has gotten out, that you have each other to decompress with a bit. And I'm just really glad that your family has the space to now thrive and grow and figure out what is good for you.
Yeah. And I guess for me, it's important to note that that was one thing that was always pitted against us, that when they got out, everybody who gets out gets together and has these meetings and has these gatherings of bashing Pastor D. So much to say with that. It's not bashing him. I mean, yeah, we do like laugh at the craziness that we were put under, but good grief. I abused so many people within that culture, and these people that we're re-meeting with, I'm making amends with. I ditched them. Like, I cut them off. I hurt them. I'm not getting together to just sit and bash the church. A lot of it is also, you know, we don't get together. I mean, I see somebody once in a blue moon. They all have their own lives. It's not like we're best friends all hanging out weekly, having these meetings. There are times when we can get together, and even if we're just sitting together, it feels oddly good because you're with somebody who knows what you went through, and you don't have to explain yourself. You don't have to explain why you're awkward. You don't have to explain why you overthought something. You don't have to explain why you're trying to make amends for something that is not a big deal, or, you know, or why you blew up because you have this anger problem. Like, it's just people who understand. It's a little bit therapeutic, and we're not doing it all the time. We want to move on. We're trying to make our own life. Mike and I are, we have some major dream plans now that we can dream. Our daughter really wants to go to Disney World. She's been asking us for 2 weeks, and we're like, okay, we have to wait till our 2-year-old is a little older. I can't handle that right now. But like, she even can have plans now, and we can say yes. Yes, we can do that. Not right now, but yes. We didn't have that. So it is hard to start over. So I don't know. That's the part of the other part that's so scary about leaving is we literally did have to start over.
Well, before you get to your last two questions, well, let's go ahead and get to the last two questions. I was just going to say, what's funny is, like, even in this situation, like, you guys can go out to eat on like a Saturday and you don't have to tell the associate pastor that you're going out to eat. Like, it's as simple as that. It's just the little things.
Or make sure that we invite somebody else, because yeah. It was highly encouraged that we invite somebody else and not do things on our own. We do miss having babysitters. We always had babysitters. That's one thing right now. We're in a season that we find tough because babysitting is very expensive. And so we don't go out very often. But man, on a Wednesday night, if we want to take the girls out to a restaurant, We can do it. Mike's planning on taking Belle camping, and he can plan a night to do that and not be worried that he's going to have to say, oh, I'm sorry, they called an event. We can't go to that. We can't camp. So yeah, there's a lot of freedom we didn't know we could have. It sounds weird to say that at 41 years old.
No, I get it. That's awesome, though. Well, I want to ask you this. Why did you want to share your story? And what would you say to others who are at this church today or other high control churches that are thinking about leaving?
So the reason I wanted to do this is, one, if there's anybody from that church listening who happens upon this podcast, you can hear my story, because I know you were not told the truth. I know what was said about me. I read the letter. I know that there are specifically women who are struggling in that community. Some of them had said they would unalive themselves and were struggling with those thoughts. I want them to hear that you don't have to have that meeting. You can leave anytime you want. You don't have to pray about it. You don't have to have a plan. You don't have to get counsel. If you don't feel safe, leave. And I am right here. I have made it very clear on my socials where I am at. You can find me, and I will open my door to you. And we will cry, and we will take care of you. We are here. I also want them to know that it will not be easy, and that, yes, it does. It is really hard. But you will survive. And in fact, you're going to thrive. Maybe not right away. I'm 2 years out, and I still feel like I have days where I just have to pick myself up out of a puddle. The other reason is I wanted to control my own narrative. I don't want Pastor D to have the final word. I am also, thirdly, hoping, not forcing, not asking, but hoping that other people will be brave enough to tell their stories so that word starts to get out and that somehow change can happen, whether he's taken out of the pulpit or I don't know what needs to, like, in my mind, I can't wrap my hand around that except it's shut down. I don't know what that's supposed to look like. But if you're a pastor, and I know those who are listening and know this area in Wisconsin, know, I pray that you guys would get together as pastors and somehow give him accountability. Maybe just tell him, look, these are what we're hearing, and this is not okay. Have an investigation started. I don't know what that looks like. I guess I'm hoping for a miracle, because there's so much hurt being happening that there are just so many, like we say, bodies under the bus. Hundreds from just the small country church. It is ridiculous, the amount of hurt. And so, yeah, those are my three main reasons for wanting to do it. And I found also that it's also therapy for me. So it's just a side note. This has been very helpful for me. So, and what was your second question?
No, that was it. You answered both
okay.
of them.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, first, just thank you. This has been, you know, this is part of Mandy's story. You know, over time, there could be more to share here, but this is the start of Mandy's story. And I just thank you, Mandy, for your time and your willingness to share and your courage to share. And I do echo Mandy's call. There's other storytellers from this church that want to share their story, to reach out, because there are more stories out there. And, you know, John and I are true believers that we need to share stories. We need to share stories. We need to hear these things. Even though they're horrible to hear, we need to hear these things, because if we're ever, ever going to bring justice and healing to a church, to the church in general and the church body, It is, in our opinion, through storytelling, through hearing and listening and of stories, and then repenting and repairing where we have harmed people. It's so critical. So Mandy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for the space.
My hands are trying to type out something that summarizes Mandy's courage, but my brain feels like it is in overdrive each time I try to organize my thoughts into a few coherent sentences. The truth is, I don't believe I can capture the litany of emotions I felt when I first heard Mandy's story. And whatever I do say cannot take back the years of hurt and isolation that Mandy and her family felt and experienced. I admit, I am no expert on religion, nor have I spent years studying and debating theology. But I do know this Bible, the one that I still read, can be misinterpreted, misunderstood, and misused. And our history, the Christian history, is filled with a plethora of examples of how we have used this faith to hurt others. Yet it sometimes still feels like we are trying like hell to protect our churches, leaders, and systems despite the stories of abuse that surface. And we will say that stories like Mandy's stories are exaggerated, aren't the full story, or are isolated and don't represent this church, this community, or this denomination. So we choose to ignore them and excuse them away, and another person, flesh and blood, like you and me, is left devastated and alone. Mandy didn't have to share her story. She had already left the church and her family was finally free and safe. But she knew there were others like her. And if her story could help one more person find the courage to get their voice and life back, it was worth it. So now it's our choice. We can continue to look away from Mandy and other storytellers like her and try to find any excuse we can come up with to not believe them. Or we can listen to and see these brave souls and acknowledge their witness and their stories and fight like hell for each one of them. For Jonna Harris, I'm Jay Coyle, and this is the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed here are the speaker's own and not those of this podcast. This content is presented for informational and educational purposes that constitute fair use, commentary, or criticism. While we make every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, we welcome any comment, suggestion, or correction of errors.